Hello, and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with a guest I'll welcome onto the show very shortly, we'll take a journey into the magical world of movies to explore how films can be a powerful reflection of real life's struggles and joys, making them so much more than just a movie. This week, it's zombie and dystopia flicks to feed the brain. Yes, today we venture far off the tracks of scientific plausibility into apocalyptic scenarios that express some of our deepest human fears about breakdowns in world order. Yes, there are zombie viruses in some of today's movies, but they're not the only dystopias we'll be encountering. I gotta tell you, I often find zombie flicks rather formulaic, so let's venture off the blazing trail forged by George A. Romero and his progeny, seeking films with unusual spins on a dystopian future. Coming up a little later, if you found a huge, mysterious object in outer space, would you bring its contents back to Earth?
150 miles long.
EGR's confirmed.
Tell them we have an artificial object out here.
In the tail of Halley's Comet, there's something wrong.
An optimistic survivor tries to convince a man without hope that all is not lost.
The world is quieter now. We just have to listen. If we listen, we can hear God's plan.
God's plan?
Yeah.
All right, let me tell you about your God's plan.
And a motley crew of survivors facing a mortal threat from above takes to the skies to hunt it down.
All right, this is Ella.
Third vertical's up. Alex, we have vision.
Monitor's coming up.
But before we get to all of that, let me introduce our guest this week. James Caselli is a videographer and short film director here in Malta. He has a Bachelor of Arts in Creative Media Production from MCAST. To date, James has three independently produced short films under his belt. To discuss some of them and his other film-related experience, he joins me in the studio today. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Fantastic to have you with us, James. So, to start with, tell us a little bit about how your love for film was born. Do you remember the moment?
I wouldn't say I remember a particular moment, but it was certainly something that started very, very early on in my life. I grew up a few years in Malta, actually, but I think where I actually started to develop more was in Italy, where I moved to when I was nine. And I remember watching films all the time. My parents were really into cinema. And so at the time, there wasn't all this streaming, you know, stuff going on, of course. So I had to just watch whatever my parents bought. I didn't have much pocket money. But they were really lovers of classics. So I did actually watch a lot of classic movies, like, let's say, Orson Welles or, Spielberg.
And the Italian classics also, since you were...
A lot of Fellini, a lot of other films that I actually don't even remember what they're called, because they were films I watched when I was very, very young, but I used to watch them over and over again, and so I did grow this, you know, sense of cinema from a young age.
Right. Yeah. And probably moments in those films that stick with you, even if you don't remember exactly.
Definitely, yeah. A lot of images and sounds here and there. I used to watch a lot of John Wayne as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have a clear first film that you really remembered as an actual sort of story of its own that stayed with you?
That is a really difficult question for anyone who really likes film, I would think.
Depends on the time of day, right?
It does. At this time of day, what comes into mind is probably it would have been a Disney animation film, something old school like Snow White, maybe.
Mm.
I can't really remember exactly which one. But
one of the real Disney classics, then.
Exactly. Yeah, it was most likely one of those.
Very cool. All right. Well, James, in your full-time day job, you're a videographer nowadays. Tell us a little bit about what that work entails. You're putting together videos for clients? Is that sort of the remit?
Well, more or less. Let's say I actually work for an iGaming company, surprisingly.
Okay,
right?
Fair enough.
But I am actually in a video team. Mm-hmm. So we do, our company is more of a marketing, SEO, online content company. So what we do is basically video content for our websites, and we do occasionally work with clients or, you know, do quite a few projects that are either related to, I don't know, sports betting or online casinos.
So the client is usually internal, is that
right?
It is,
yeah, mostly, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And how does that work? Do you get a lot of creative kind of input, or does this sort of the client team that's internal give you a sort of typically a script and a clear storyboard of what they want, or is that a collaboration? How does that work?
Okay, well, actually, I would say that I am very involved in the creative process right from the start. So when it comes to script writing, I mostly write the scripts myself, unless it is especially big projects that we're taking on, you know, something that's not part of our daily things, that the script might come from someone else, or I would have some very strict, guidance on what to do. But most of the time, I am very involved in the creative process. We do brainstorm a lot. We try different things. So I am deep in that process.
So that's cool. So it's not like a cookie cutter thing where they give you kind of the video recipe and you just go away and sort of implement it. You've got creative input as well.
Yeah, let's say I'm part of who makes the recipe as well.
Okay, very nice. And that's cool. And in terms of videography as a job, the production pipeline of that, which part do you find yourself enjoying most? Are you someone who prefers being on set shooting, or is it the post process, the editing, the color correction? Which bit do you really get your teeth into?
Well, mostly what I do is probably scripts and directing.
Okay.
I do head the, let's say, live action part of the work. So we do a tad of animation as well, but that's quite a new thing.
So when you say live action, do you mean like the studios where kind of gaming activities are being filmed?
By live action, I mean anything that's filmed with a camera that's not animated or created in 3D, let's say. So anything real.
Got you.
But yeah, we do have a studio of our own, which is, it's quite small, but we get everything done in there that we need to. We have like five sets in one room. It's really crazy. Like, cause it's such a small space, we have to get creative. So if you stand in the middle of the room and you turn in one direction, it's one set. You turn to the other direction, it's another set.
Okay, but you've got lighting rigs and setups and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. So let's shift a bit here, James. If we go from the production side, which you're obviously very involved in as a videographer, towards the appreciation side of film as viewers, what for you would be the key elements, do you think, that contribute to making a movie that really sticks in your mind as a viewer long after the credits have rolled?
Well, you know, that is a difficult question, and I think it's a question that everyone wants to crack, right? Especially people who make films.
Mm.
So I can give you, my point of view, what I like to see in films. I like to see something that really grabs you and keeps you in the seat. You know, to me, that is a sign of a great film that isn't boring, you know? It's something that, you know, even if it's 2.5 hours, you feel like it's 90 minutes.
Mm.
And I think what it comes down to is having a good script. I think everything starts from there. You need great actors, which is something that sometimes is overlooked, especially independent projects. If the acting isn't convincing, you could have a great script. It's not going to work because it's not believable what's being said. So acting, script writing, and the vision of the director have to really blend together well for something to work.
Because it's such a collaborative effort always, isn't it?
It is.
And I think you've touched on something interesting there with that point about the filmmaker engaging the audience. I mean, sometimes I watch films and the opening scenes are sort of perhaps a bit slow, and they're obviously getting at something. You know, as a storyteller, as a visual storyteller, you obviously have an idea of what you want to tell. But to your point, it's really important, isn't it, to grab the viewer as early as you can in the runtime of your film.
The opening scene is probably the most important scene of any film, really. Maybe in the grand scheme of things it isn't, but when it comes to actually engaging your audience, you have to start strong, or else, especially in these days when people just don't have patience and there's so many things to watch, you really need to stand out. And in fact, the best films do have great opening scenes. Like, just think of, I don't know what comes to mind right now, just think of your favorite film and think of the opening scene. You'll probably remember what it is. I wish I could come up with something on the fly.
No, I understand. And of course, you mentioned earlier online streaming. And of course, companies like Netflix are very carefully looking at statistics about how long into films their viewers watch, right? I mean, so
exactly, yeah.
They probably have very clear metrics on which films have strong opening scenes because people watch them for longer, or they watch more viewers view the film to completion. So it backs up your point, really, about the importance of an opening.
It applies also to TV shows as well. If you think of a season as a film and you think of the first episode as the opening scene sequence, just next time you watch a show, try to judge it from the first episode. The pilot is designed to hook you. if the pilot doesn't work most of the time, I'm not going to continue watching the show.
Right.
Because that means the rest probably won't engage me. You know, at least I get the feeling.
And indeed, sometimes the pilot itself is used to sell the concept of the entire show to a production studio or something as well, right?
Exactly. And even if you try to sell a spec script, which is, you know, me just writing a script and trying to sell it to big movie studios, they will read the beginning. And if they don't like it, they're not going to read the rest. You know, it's all judged on the beginning. Now, we're probably going into a different area of discussion here.
That's okay.
But yeah, my point is it needs to start strong, a film. That's very important.
So but just drilling into that subject of narrative and a strong opening for a minute, do you think a film which breaks the rules of sort of classical structure, whether you're a proponent of the three-act or the five-act sort of movie breakdown and strong character arcs, do you think a film that breaks a lot of those rules can still prove engaging for an audience?
Well, it could. I would say that is the area. I think you're touching on an experimental film a bit. And I think this story about the structure is, I think every film is slightly structured differently. But you're right, there are films that try to change the formula, and it's a bit of a gamble, to be honest. I think it's all up to the vision of whoever writes slash directs the film. If there's a point to the experiment you're making, and you personally, with your vision, you know it works, there's a good chance that it will work because you have something new and fresh, right? But you could also have experimental films where it's just, you know, throwing things at the wall and see what sticks.
Right.
And those can really fail. So they could definitely work, but it is risky. You need to know what you're doing.
Sure. And a lot of the screenplay theory that's out there does seem to suggest that the three-act structure that tends to be so common in the way films are written and produced nowadays is somehow codifying an innate kind of storytelling format that we relate to as humans.
Yeah, it goes quite deep, actually. Storytelling is, you know, there are some theories out there, but it's really innate in people to tell stories. You know, maybe in the caveman era, we were like telling stories to each other about what happened. And they're not too much different to that, you know, just life experiences. And yeah, the three-act structure does actually, or any, all these other different structures, they do apply to many different films. But sometimes you can apply something, but it doesn't necessarily mean that whoever created it did it that way.
Right.
You know, it kind
of just happened organically.
Yeah, it's something that can happen later that you just slap onto it, right? Some filmmakers abide by these structures, some less. It is a bit of a debatable thing, I would say. I would suggest to read Anatomy of Screenplay by John Truby, who is a great script doctor in Hollywood. And that book does touch on these things a lot and is really interesting, but yeah, obviously we have time to talk about it too much.
That's great. No, thanks for these thoughts. Little change of pace now, James. So our episode this week is entitled Zombie and Dystopia Flicks to Feed the Brain. I wonder, do you have a particular movie in this subgenre that you're really fond of?
Actually, I do, and it is Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men.
I can't really remember when I last had any hope. And I certainly can't remember when anyone else did either. Because really, since women stopped being able to have babies, what's left to hope for?
The world was stunned today by the death of Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet. The youngest person on Earth was 18 years, 4 months, 20 days, 16 hours, and 8 minutes old.
So, from 2006, as James mentioned, Alfonso Cuarón's powerful science fiction drama. What did you love so much about this film, James?
Oh, you know, there's so much to say about it, but, you know, trying to mention only the things that stand out. I would say, first of all, when even in the first 10 minutes you realize this is just a master filmmaker, you know, it's just everything about it is great, in my opinion. I think the way it's shot a bit like a documentary. You feel like you're in it. It's very realistic, gritty, tangible world, and it feels very real. It feels like something that could happen. I don't know if you want me to summarize it a bit.
You can certainly give a quick pitch, yeah, if well, people haven't seen it.
Okay, great. It is set in the alternate future, of course. I'm not sure if they mentioned the year. I think it's maybe 20 years from now, something like that.
The near future, right?
Near future. And Alfonso Cuarón wanted to create, it's set in London, by the way, wanted to create this world in London that is similar to third world countries. You know, so London looks like something, he mentions it looks a bit more like Mexico City. I've never been there, so I can't vouch for that. But that's what the director said. He wanted to give a feel of a second, third world country in London, which is seen as, you know, this giant metropolis, which is like one of the centers of the world. And you have a great opening scene, which shows you that the world is infertile, like there's this pandemic of infertility, epidemic, sorry. And yeah, there's all these issues that we have today, like let's say immigration or war tensions and things like that, and they're just escalated so much. So that's why it feels real, because it grabs issues that are seeping into our society today that are very present, but it puts them to 11. Like, what if we fast forward 20 years from now and these problems keep growing?
Yeah, so it was a very sort of socially aware and sort of prescient narrative about society, but also, as you mentioned, there's effects in the film. There's a city street with all sorts of strange, you know, billboards and vehicles, but it's done in quite a sort of a naturalistic way. It doesn't draw attention to that.
Yeah, because you have London that's kind of falling to bits. The buildings have cracks and are a bit grimy, but then at the same time you have these neon signs and adverts and posters are animated, you know, things that you would see typically in something like Blade Runner.
Right.
So it blends those two things together, showing that it's a tad in the future, but also that the world is really becoming a mess. It already is a mess, actually.
And I also recall that later in the film, there's some very gritty sort of military combat scenes. You know, it's very vividly depicted wartime moments in the film.
It is. That's one of the things I like about it. It's intense the whole way through. And even when you have a more mellow scene, for example, two characters talking to each other, there's a Michael Caine is great in it. He plays this sort of stoner character with long hair. And even these moments are great because of the camera work, it feels like almost like a Vice documentary, like the cameraman is walking up to them, shoving the camera in their face and moving it around. And there's this use of wide lenses, which shows you all the environment around them. So you get a chance to stare at all the world building and all the sets, which are so well done. It's really realistic. And yeah, it keeps you engaged the whole time. There's things to look at and to hear all the time during the film.
Great, so highly recommended there from James. That's 2006's Alfonso Cuarón movie, Children of Men. Thank you, James.
Yeah.
So let's move back to talking about some of your work now. As I mentioned in the intro, you've directed some short films here in Malta?
Yeah, a few, yes, I have.
Okay, tell me a little bit about how you would typically bring your team together for these productions.
Yeah, sure. Most of them are actually student films that I did during my time at MCAST. But to say the truth, it was more of an excuse to have the time to work on my own things, you know, having these assignments, you know. So I would say, what would I love to make? I'm not just making it for school, you know. I'm making it because I want to make a short.
You were studying, but you were also hungry to...
Yeah, it gave me the opportunity to make them, right? Okay. And yeah, they are, you know, my first kind of works, because they date back to a few years ago, most of them. So I'm doing different things now, and I rarely do shorts these days, although I always have the need to, and I always want to do them.
So one of your shorts was a science fiction short. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, Marvin. That definitely came out of my obsession with Black Mirror at the time and similar sci-fi films. I am a sci-fi fan.
Okay.
And most of my films do have a touch of sci-fi in them, or something supernatural, or let's say tackles big questions, you know, at least in a subconscious, subtle way.
So what's kind of the log line for Marvin?
Yeah, okay.
The pitch there?
Log line of Marvin is that a scientist who works for a big pharmaceutical company, sorry, I slurred that word a bit, pharmaceutical company, and he creates this implant, this machine that you put in someone's head, and it blends software with your brain's hardware. And it can do things like cure memory issues like dementia or other brain-related diseases and problems that have never been able to be cured before.
So it's the story of an engineer who builds kind of an artificial intelligence upgrade in a way?
Yes, yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention that, which is actually an important point. It is an artificial intelligence.
Okay.
And the point is that, well, obviously it's science fiction, but the point is that the AI would do most of the heavy lifting rather than the scientists. You create an AI that can fix a lot of different problems, and you just throw it in the brain.
Okay.
And it detects and fixes stuff. This doesn't really explain the film that much, but I can get into it.
But that's the setup for
yeah,
the story.
It is.
So was it a film with a lot of effects? Were there a lot of sort of technical challenges in making it?
Doing a short film is always a challenge. Probably the main thing is that there were a lot of people involved. If you would watch it, you'd notice there's a lot of different characters, probably too many, to be honest, now I think about it. Sorry, I'm just like a big critic of my own work.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I think the biggest problem was probably getting everyone on set and, you know, all these shooting days. Technically, it wasn't too difficult, let's say, because it's quite simply shot. I did think about it, before. I you know, had storyboards and everything ready. So actually shooting it, it was just a matter of getting the lines out from the actors, directing, right?
How much of it was sort of sticking to your sort of carefully scripted and storyboarded scenes, and how much of it was improvised when you were actually on set with your performers?
Not much was improvised, actually. It was it stuck quite closely to the storyboard and the script. So, but the thing is, when you have a storyboard and then you go and actually film the thing, it's going to be slightly different because you have the actor to work with. They're not something that you're drawing on a page. They're actually a person. You need to get a line out. So yeah, but it was quite similar to my initial idea.
Right,
you
stuck to the plan.
Yeah, I did.
So, if I'm not mistaken, moving on to another of your short films called Petrolhead, am I right in saying you shot that in black and white? Do I remember that correctly?
Yes, it was shot in black and white.
Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so Petrolhead was the experimental I made, which was actually screened in Valletta when it first came out, 2018, I believe. Yeah, 2018. Okay. It's a bit of a weird one, You want me to summarize the plot?
Sure, please.
If there is even a plot.
to the extent it has one, yes.
Well, I don't want to reveal too much, but I would say if you watch it, the point was kind of to show a motor engine addict in a sort of weird experimental filmmaking way.
So
that makes sense.
You wanted to sort of visualize the obsessive side of gearheads, motorheads.
Exactly. So the black and white is he has a leather jacket and there's lots of objects that have a lot of reflections, like night shots. And that I wanted to give a sense of the chrome, of an engine, like of the metal and stuff. So I don't know if that worked. But I'm happy that I decided to keep it in black and white. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
That's fine. I mean, I certainly thought it was a visually striking movie, so I think you achieved your goal there. So.
Thank you.
So talking about these short films and the role of a director, what's your style? I mean, do you tend to give your performers very specific beats to hit, or have you left it for them to do their prep, read the script, develop their backstory for the characters, and come and do the role on the day? How has it typically worked on your films so far?
Well, usually I send the script to the actor. I summarize a bit like, hey, I have this script and I thought you'd be great in this. If you have time and if you want, if you find it interesting, I'd be happy to have you. And they would read it most of the time. And they would come back to me. I wouldn't say beforehand anything about it, really, more than that.
You'll just leave it to them and see what they make of it.
They just read it and then they come back to me and say, oh, the role is interesting. And then I like what you wrote here, or I don't like what you said there. And then we kind of talk it out. And then I explain what I had initially in mind. But first they tell me the feeling they got from the script. And there's just a back and forth until we mutually agree on things.
So then it becomes sort of a creative negotiation.
Exactly. Well, I wouldn't say too much a negotiation, because usually the actor doesn't want to step on the writer's feet too much, in my experience.
Okay.
Sometimes, if something doesn't make sense, or if you think it would make the film bad, if it's actually a bad idea, no, they're going to tell you.
Right, the logic problems are important.
Yeah,
if it's
a creative decision, a character decision, they usually leave it up to the director, to me.
Okay,
in my cases.
There's a bit of a cliche, I think, in filmmaking, that the actor sort of gets on set and is telling the writer, the line shouldn't be this, it should be that. But you seem to be saying that doesn't tend to happen that often in your experience.
Well, it depends on the person, I guess, but to me it hasn't happened much. I've had some moments where I had to, everybody stop everything and let's talk about this. And they're like, this line doesn't make sense. You talk for a bit, but then you come to some kind of agreement. There's never been anything too dramatic.
Right. And that may be a good thing, that sort of discussion needs to happen in places.
That really comes down to what I said at the beginning about the script being very important. A script includes obviously characters, because the characters are made up of what's written on the script. They don't exist anywhere else, really. Only in your head.
And I think there's a temptation, because you've obviously involved in writing as well, as am I, and there's a temptation as a writer to put a lot of direct direction for the actors on the page, which obviously is not what we want to be doing as writers. We want to be leaving the nuance of the performance to the actors to interpret for themselves, right?
I do agree with that, although there are some directors that wouldn't I think. I can't really name any.
Who are more prescriptive, you mean, about directions?
Yeah, they're very precise, and they have something very precise in mind, and you really can't go off of that. I think, I might be wrong on this, but I think Kubrick was a bit like that. He was very precise and, what's the word,
Right, sort of, yeah, he knows exactly what beats he wants from his performers, I think. At least that's what reports seem to suggest.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, I think mixing ideas is better overall, I think, for creativity.
James, what do you think about the current state of the film industry here in Malta overall?
The film industry in Malta, well, I know a lot of foreign productions are made here. Maltese films, I heard of this Lutsu film, but I haven't seen it yet.
Right.
But I would like to. I don't think it's available yet for us to watch.
It's not been released here, but I've been in touch with the director, and one of the actresses is
right.
going to be a guest on the show here on More Than a Movie in upcoming weeks, so we're excited about that. But yeah, I'm excited about Lutsu as well. But please, continue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have any specific insights. I do sometimes, go as an extra or featured extra. Just to see how they work, get a peek into that world.
Right, we do have a chance here in Malta to work as extras and featured on some fairly big productions.
Oh, yeah.
That come out to shoot here, which is nice, isn't
it? Yeah, that's always fun. I mean, it's hard work, but it is fun.
Absolutely. James, are you writing or developing anything at the moment in terms of short films or independent projects?
I think since COVID hit, that kind of took a backseat. I would say I am at this moment in time, I am more inclined to help someone else make their own short come true. So I do have a couple of friends here and there who are, either starting to work on something or thinking to start to work on something. So I'm leaving myself open for that, and probably after that, I will start making my own stuff again. I do have some ideas boiling.
Mm-hmm.
I do have some half scripts written, some treatments here and there. Nothing really planned, per se.
Right, nothing's quite coalesced.
No, not yet.
And in terms of helping friends, are you thinking about that in terms of being a director of the film, or perhaps shooting the film for them, or in what capacity?
Oh, I mean, I do a bit of everything, really. So whatever they need, to be honest. No, I wouldn't take the director's seat unless they really offered that to me, which I don't think would happen, because if someone wants to make their own film, they would direct it, I would assume.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. But out of the people I know, no, they would definitely direct it. I would probably help them film it from behind the camera, yeah.
Gotcha. James, if people want to learn a bit more about some of your work, is there somewhere online they can go to do so?
Yes, I don't have too much of a strong presence online, but I could tell you that I have a YouTube channel and a website. You want me to give you the details?
Yeah, what's the YouTube channel?
Okay, the YouTube channel is simply just my name and surname, James Caselli, that is Caselli.
Okay.
And my website, which has like the free website domain attached to it, but it is jamescaselli.wixsite, which is wixsite.com. So jamescaselli.wixsite.com. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, James. Well, look, it was great having you on the show. Thanks for all your insights and interesting ideas. We hope we'll be seeing lots more of your work, hopefully on a big screen near us very soon.
I hope so too. Thank you for inviting me.
A pleasure. Now then, what about zombie and dystopia flicks that were shot here in Malta? Well, of course, there's one glaringly obvious title that probably needs little introduction to local film buffs. Former United Nations worker Jerry Lane trots the globe in an effort to thwart a zombie pandemic threatening to destroy humanity itself. From 2013, this is World War Z.
It's the same worldwide. Anyone doing better than we are?
We've lost the East Coast. Moscow's still dark. Life as we know it will come to an end in 90 days.
It's on us to change that.
I can't leave my family.
Don't pretend your family is exempt. When we talk about the end of humanity,
I don't want to leave you, but I have to go.
I'll keep our kids safe.
Mark Forster directs Brad Pitt, of course, alongside Mireille Enos and David Morse. World War Z certainly pulls out all the stops in depicting the pandemonium of a total breakdown in world order as a furious wave of zombies sweep the globe. Well, this was a big production here in Malta, with several locations on the island doubling up for the holy city of Jerusalem. Indeed, we have scenes shot on the streets of Valletta with zombies literally hoarding through the narrow passageways.
The memo sent from this installation. It's pretty obvious nobody back home bothered to read it.
If I could get into Russia, where would I start?
Russia's a black hole.
I need answers.
Guns are half measure.
You with the CIA?
But they're not with me.
The film also features that famous wide aerial shot of a huge concrete wall with digitally animated zombies attempting to scale it by piling on top of one another, literally in their thousands. This movie was plagued, see what I did there, by reports of production problems and reshoots. So, is it any good? Well, critical reception was pretty mixed on this one, I have to say. Many mainstream commentators bemoaned the film's lack of depth and substance. Audiences, though, seem to have flocked to World War Z regardless. So if waves of mindless terror sweeping cityscapes is your thing, then enjoy the local scenery and take a look at World War Z.
I need you to help him.
You're asking me to leave my family.
I'm not gonna force you.
Don't pretend you're not well suited for the job.
Baby?
Tell the kids I'm coming back.
Well, it's now time to venture beyond Malta's unscalable urban edifices to discover some dystopias to truly feed our brains. Our first film goes way back to the 80s.
They watched. They waited. Now their time has come. Out of the depths of space, the ultimate terror. Moving, searching, destroying. From body to body, from life to life, from man to woman. Changing, growing, burning for our life force.
Yes, from 1985, this is Life Force. Talk about a movie that defies categorization. This one has to be up there. Life Force is a film which literally crams in a bit of everything. It starts out in space, apparently a science fiction movie, but things soon drop out of orbit to Earth. And from there on in, the film just gets weirder and weirder, and, quite frankly, crazier and crazier.
From the director of Poltergeist and the writer of Alien, comes a terrifying new film.
I'm getting a very small radar cross-section.
150 miles long?
EGR's confirmed.
Tell them we have an artificial object out here.
In the tail of Halley's Comet, there's something wrong. Something ancient. Something evil.
Well, the director here is Tobe Hooper, a prolific horror director in the 70s and 80s. He's probably best known for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the brilliant supernatural Steven Spielberg collaboration from 1980 that was Poltergeist. Also check out Hooper's chilling Salem's Lot from 1979, starring David Soule and James Mason. Well, unlike those pieces, all quite tightly constrained in terms of genre and theme, in Life Force, Tobe Hooper and his team pull out every imaginable stop on their cinematic organ. There's a mind-controlling seductress from outer space, animatronic zombie creatures, wacky laser effects, the list just goes on and on.
Houston, we have a problem.
Something's happening to me.
Something hungry that's brought to Earth.
She's destroyed worlds.
That girl was no girl. She's totally alien to this planet and our life form. And totally dangerous.
This certainly isn't a horror flick to be taken very seriously. The action borders on comically absurd in several places. It is, though, without doubt, tremendous fun and a pretty much non-stop ride. And there's a surprisingly intricate plot that develops, penned here by Dan O'Bannon, who also wrote the screenplay of the classic sci-fi movie Alien. Well, here for Life Force, O'Bannon adapted Colin Wilson's novel, imaginatively entitled The Space Vampires, Uwer. In something of a precursor to today's Malta movie that we just mentioned, World War Z, the final act of Life Force literally descends into total anarchy as the streets of London are ravaged in a zombie apocalypse. The effects here, of course, are mostly practical, using models and prosthetics rather than computer-generated visuals, and the framing of the action consequently feels quite a bit closer than the plentiful wide angles of digitalized World War Z. But Life Force's apocalypse is no less disturbing, culminating in a totally bizarre climax in a church.
Why do I feel so close to you? Need you?
Because you're one of us.
You always have been. You're like me. Be with me. Just a little more. Just a little more.
You'll recognize various faces from the movie, including Star Trek's Patrick Stewart in, frankly, a totally wacko role here. I mean, this whole thing plays a bit like a movie on acid, I kid you not. If ever there was a dystopian film that spanned multiple genres, this is it. It had a huge budget and is very good looking in several moments. There's spectacular production design on some huge sets, as well as ambitious sci-fi horror effects, supervised by legend John Dykstra. So yes, a visually impressive, yet thematically rather awkward genre piece, although a thoroughly darned entertaining one at that. You simply have to see it to believe it. Be warned, there's lots of grisly horror makeup and models, accompanied by oodles of blood. But if your recent outings on streaming services have felt a little, confined, then break out of thine cinematic shackles with the utterly wackadoodle 1985 movie that is Life Force.
Close your eyes.
Visited you how?
To my mind.
Let it go!
It's already spreading. You didn't stop it, it's too late.
And a movie at this level had a predictably high-quality soundtrack, so let's have a better listen to that main theme from Life Force, composed here by Henry Mancini. And so at that, we get a bit more serious for the remainder of our dystopian episode today. Let's jump to the early 2000s as we look at a very different vision of a future dystopian England. This time, the cause of the global apocalypse is a furious mythical beast.
A creature has been awakened that has lain dormant for millions of years. A species older than the dinosaurs and more terrifying than anything we could have imagined.
How did they go from 1 to 1 million in less than a year?
Highly evolved.
They have great vision in the day. They have even better vision at night.
From 2002, this is Rob Bowman's action fantasy Reign of Fire, starring Christian Bale and Matthew McConaughey. Well, this story starts out with a prologue in the subways beneath London, where the tunnel boring work truly does awaken the slumbering beast.
you haven't guessed it already, this is a film about dragons. And a dystopian film at that. Yes, you heard me, a pretty rare combination, to be sure, but it proves to be a very effective one here. We move to the grim north of the UK, to the dark shale pits of mining country Northumberland. A ragtag bunch of survivors is holed up, led by Bale, eking out a fearful subsistence under the omniscient threat of the airborne beasts. Now, Rob Bowman is really experienced. He directed 34 episodes of the superb sci-fi mystery show, The X-Files. What's notable about Reign of Fire, then, is that it's principally an action film, but with a capably rendered post-apocalyptic backdrop. It's not shy to borrow from famous predecessors visually, yet it combines intriguing elements. Horseback riding, helicopter gunships, parachuting dragon hunters, and armored tanks. Fear not, though, for as unlikely as this all sounds, it works really well. In particular, breakneck editing and superb sound design render vivid action sequences. Let's have a listen to the build-up of one of those hunts in the film.
Understand what's going on? I'm at altitude. We're line up here.
Can you give me some time?
Having trouble with the third vertical.
Alex, we have vision.
Monitor's coming up.
And, well, McConaughey's in bald-headed, cigar-chomping military mode here. A bit of a cliche, maybe, but the arrival of his team heralds a last-ditch effort to save the community from their fiery marauders, eventually leading them back to London, the centre of this nest of airborne vipers.
You heard him! Lock and load! Let's move! Let's move!
Well, dragons have always fascinated me, one of my favourite mythical creatures. I must say, though, that I've mostly found their depiction in motion pictures to be left wanting, and Reign of Fire is one notable exception to that trend. Yes, even Peter Jackson's dragon in his second Hobbit movie, The Desolation of Smaug from 2013, voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch, whilst a technical tour de force to be sure, somehow didn't ring true for me. I know. Dragons aren't real, right? So how could a portrayal of one possibly ring true? Doesn't make much sense, huh? But come on, folks, we're talking mythical creatures here. Cut me a break, would you? I guess I'm just that kind of guy. And for me, the principal characteristic of the beast that is the dragon is that of anger, pure wrath and fiery rage unleashed. As you can probably guess, the climax of Reign of Fire does a terrific job putting that trait on full display. Fear not, though, for there's plenty of perfectly decent drama interspersed with all this action. It's well performed by Christian Bale and his supporting cast, which includes Isabella Skorupko and Gerard Butler, no less. So yeah, if you like dragons and you dig dystopias, then Reign of Fire is pretty much a must-see movie. See?
and, I feel, a very underrated one. Just terrific fantasy action filmmaking all round. Next, how can we possibly talk about modern apocalypse films without this title? Years after a plague kills most of humanity and transforms the rest into horrific monsters, the sole survivor in New York City struggles valiantly to find a cure.
I'm not infected, please!
Nothing happened the way it was supposed to happen. 6 billion people on Earth when the infection hit. I'm a survivor living in New York City. I will be at the South Street Seaport every day at midday when the sun is highest in the sky.
This is, of course, the 2007 action sci-fi film I Am Legend. If you're a regular listener to our show, you might remember episode 8 from the first season when we discussed 20th century American author Richard Matheson. Well, his 1954 novel is adapted here for the third time as a motion picture. The previous film adaptations are 1964's Last Man on Earth, starring horror legend Vincent Price, and 1971's The Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston. In this third iteration, A-list actor Will Smith takes on the role of Dr. Robert Neville in a fantastically cinematic opening, arguably one of the best in recent years. We first meet Neville hunting deer on the deserted streets of a long-abandoned Manhattan. His motorized steed is a Ford Shelby. And small aside, I once drove to Las Vegas in one of these exact cars with friends. What a noisy beast. So anyway, check out the superb sound design used here. Director Francis Lawrence had a background in music videos before moving on to full-length feature films. We discussed his 2005 fantasy movie Constantine back in episode 5 of the first season of this show. Lawrence is a brilliantly visual filmmaker, and that's on full display in I Am Legend. It essentially tells the story of the one man left behind, hoping, beyond hope, to reverse the cruel twist of fate that has befallen humanity.
Sleep. Eat your vegetables. Don't just push them around. Eat them. I'm not playing.
War!
Morning, Hank. Midway through the G's.
Arguably a beautiful metaphor for depression, the creatures here are something of a hybrid between vampires and zombies. But they're a little bit beside the point, in my view. The film really hones in on the psychological isolation, nay, desolation, felt by our protagonist. We get important exposition and backstory of what happened to the planet through powerful flashback sequences, which chronicle the 11th hour military evacuation of the island city. Check out this dramatic scene as Neville drives his wife and child to the helicopter airlift station.
Why did you say you're going?
That's not enough.
Robert, you said you're going, not we're going.
All right, when you get across, I need you to get to the ATM. Get as much cash as you can get.
It's not even summer, you know.
Take Sarah's car, go upstate. I'll meet you at the farm. Bring enough food for 2 weeks.
Jesus, Robert, did it jump? Is it airborne?
Well, we only go to Aunt Sarah's in the summer.
It may be.
Oh, my God.
It's Christmas. What about my presents?
He's announcing.
Make no mistake, my fellow Americans.
You left my Christmas virus in the closet.
Is a lethal enemy.
Hush now, Mark.
It threatens the survival of not only our nation, but of every other nation.
Mommy, look, it's a butterfly.
Marley, enough.
So it is with great sadness, but even greater resolve, that tonight I have signed an executive order initiating a military quarantine of New York City. God be with us.
This has been a special...
The window is still open. We find something in a week or 2 weeks, we can reverse the spread. I can still fix this.
Please. You can do the same work outside the city.
Ground Zero. This is my site. We talked about this.
What are you doing?
What am I doing? I'm not gonna let this happen.
This isn't up to you. You can't.
Some criticism was leveled at the film for the creature design and animation, as well as an alternate ending for the film, which later did the rounds. Both those gripes, I think, missed the point of this parable, though, which is really to give a sobering, albeit fantastical, warning of the perils of delving too deeply down the scientific rabbit hole. Our sorry hero's loneliness, of course, continues to mount. In a parallel of Tom Hanks' best buddy volleyball Wilson from the brilliant film Castaway, Dr. Neville is reduced to conversing with shopfront dummies that he's arranged in a local video rental store to create some semblance of a human connection.
Promise, my friend, I will say hello to you today. Hello. Hello. Please say hello to me. Please say hello to me.
In the inevitable crisis of hopelessness that eventually befalls our hero, he meets an optimistic and religiously faithful woman traveling with a child to a supposed colony up north. But convincing Neville to join them proves no mean feat.
The world is quieter now. You just have to listen. If you listen, we can hear God's plan.
God's plan?
Yeah.
All right, let me tell you about your God's plan. 6 billion people on Earth when the infection hit. KV had a 90% kill rate. That's 5.4 billion people dead, crashed and bled out dead. Less a 1% immunity. Left 12 million healthy people like you, me, and Ethan. The other 588 million turned into your dark seekers. And then they got hungry and they killed and fed on everybody. Everybody. Every single person that you or I has ever known is dead. Dead! There is no God. There is no God.
A Hollywood blockbuster, this may well be, but for me, this is one of the most vividly rendered depictions of a post-apocalyptic world yet committed to film, with a beautiful soundtrack. It also has one of the most poignant and well-judged endings I can recall seeing in a sci-fi film. There are frightening and violent moments, to be sure, so do be warned, but for dystopian cinema, it's hard to do much better than this. One of my very favorite films ever. Please do check out I Am Legend.
Day 1001. My name is Robert Neville. I am a survivor living in New York City. I am broadcasting on all AM frequencies. If you are out there, if anyone is out there, please.
A change of pace and scale, then, for our last movie today. In a post-zombie world where, thanks to medication, the infected are able to live normal lives, their retroviral drug is fast running out.
You gotta have something there to take care of those zombies.
They're not zombies, they've been returned.
They're zombies.
The return protein works as a barrier. It's kind of like a retaining wall. The incubated virus is always there, but the daily dosage keeps it at a safe distance.
These people are time bombs. If they miss just one dosage, one, there's no going back.
From 2013, this is Manuel Carballo's thriller-slash-crime drama, The Returned, not to be confused with a TV series of the same name from 1 year before, in 2012. Yes, this is a film about the aftermath of a zombie pandemic, but the dystopia here is a rather gentler, contemporary setting. Canadian actress Emily Hampshire is the lead, as a physician whose husband, played by Chris Holden Reed, is himself one of the returned. Of course, she'll do almost anything to guarantee his supply of the drug that keeps him from succumbing to the virus.
6 years ago, I was returned.
We haven't received the stuff from the lab this week.
What?
There's 7 dead return at St. John's Hospital and 12 at Central. They can't be sure it was the anti-return groups, but it doesn't look good.
We're safe here.
No, we're not.
Yeah, the trailer doesn't really do this film justice, in my opinion, as it draws up a really convincing backstory. The film's well acted and boasts a very nice soundtrack, which underpins the rather sad nature of this dystopian tale. Good cerebral sci-fi dystopia there in The Returned. So, what did you think of the movie selection in our show? For that or any other feedback, please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thanks to our guest, James Caselli, for joining us, and of course to our sound engineer today, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io, and those clips are licensed under creativecommons.org, version 4. Thank you so much for listening. I do hope you'll join us again next week for another episode of More Than a Movie.